This is your last chance to enter the Ohio Lottery's Fun Turns 50 promotion. Score $3,500 and two tickets to the epic party at the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, where you could win part of another $400,000 in cash prizes. Enter the new 50th anniversary scratch-off or $50 worth of eligible non-winning $5 or $10 scratch-offs and My Lotto rewards through the Ohio Lottery app. Hurry up! The last entry deadline is May 13th. Lottery players are subject to Ohio laws and commission regulations. Play responsibly.
What does motion sound like? With Kizik Hands Free Shoes, it sounds a little something like this. Experience the magic of motion. Get a free pair of socks with your first order at kizik.com/socks.
Ow!
Those uncomfortable things we do for beauty.
Oof. Ouch.
And when it comes to whiter teeth, same story. Until now. Enjoy Wince-Free Whitening with new Sensodyne Clinical White. You'll get clinically proven whitening technology in an enamel-safe formula for two shades whiter teeth and 24/7 sensitivity protection. Sensodyne Clinical White, a whiter smile without the wince.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Welcome to the New Books in African Studies, a podcast channel of the New Books Network. I'm your host, Elisa Prosperetti. Today, I will be talking to Professor Usman Khan about the new volume that he has edited, called Islamic Scholarship in Africa, New Directions and Global Contexts. Islamic Scholarship in Africa has just been published in spring 2021 by James Curry as part of the Religion in Transforming Africa series. The volume is coming out contemporaneously in French, titled Érudition islamique en Afrique, Nouvelle piste de recherche et contexte mondial, which is published by Dakar Serdis. And Serdis will be publishing paperback versions of both English and French. Usman is the Prince Al-Walid bin Talal Professor of Contemporary Islamic Religion and Society at the Harvard Divinity School. He's the author of numerous works, including 2016's Beyond Timbuktu, An Intellectual History of Muslim West Africa. Usman, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you for inviting me, Elisa.
It's really an honor and a pleasure. And I know that you addressed this at length in Beyond Timbuktu, and if anyone's interested, they can pick it up. You have such a fascinating personal history. I wonder if you could tell the listeners a little bit about who you are and where you come from and how you became drawn to the world of scholarship.
Sure. I was born in Senegal. And I grew up there, received primary and secondary education in public schools in Senegal, in the French language. But simultaneously, I also attended Quranic school and received also higher Islamic education. So after completing secondary school in Senegal, I relocated to France where I studied political science and Middle Eastern studies, and I received my PhD from Sciences Po Paris in 1993. And I also studied higher Islamic education, received a master's degree in higher Islamic education. So after receiving my PhD, I returned to Senegal where I taught at the Université Gaston Berger de Saint-Louis for 9 years, almost 10, where I was a professor or an assistant professor of political science. And I left Senegal in 2000, spent 1 year at Yale as a postdoc at the program of program in agrarian studies. Then moved to Columbia University, where I was appointed associate professor of international and public affairs. And I taught 10 years at Columbia. And I left Columbia in 2012 to Harvard, where I am now a professor of contemporary Islamic religion and society. And most of my research now, my research and teaching is focused on Islamic intellectual history, especially Islamic intellectual history in Africa. So You mentioned my book, Beyond Tombouctou, published 2016, and in French as Au-delà de Tombouctou, Érudition islamique et histoire intellectuelle en Afrique subsaharienne. So I wrote Beyond Tombouctou because I wanted to tell a story of Islamic erudition in Africa, which was unknown to many Europhone intellectuals, to many African intellectuals educated in European languages, such as French, English, and Portuguese, who many of whom have no idea of how old this intellectual tradition is and how important is the contribution of Africans to the Islamic intellectual tradition. You know, in Freetown, Sierra Leone, the Church Missionary Society created Fura Bay College in 1827 as the first college to offer instruction in European languages in West Africa. But at that time, several Islamic centers of learning existed, and in Timbuktu, in Gao, in Djéné, in Pir Sagnohor in Senegal, in Kano, in Borno, and in so many other places. And Africans have been traveling to study and teach all over the world for several centuries. And that part of the story of Islamic erudition in Africa was unknown to most Europhone intellectuals. And that was the reason of my writing Beyond Timbuktu, an intellectual history of Muslim West Africa.
Yeah, I believe you refer to, Fura Bay, Sierra Leone was just an island in a sea of higher education institutions in the Islamic world. And I think this kind of reframing is absolutely foundational to African studies. So you gave us your intellectual academic journey, but there's also a parallel journey that you refer to in Beyond Timbuktu that starts in Kaolack.
Right. My mother is the daughter of Sheikh Ibrahim Niass, who is one of the most prolific scholars, Islamic scholars, and influential Sufi leaders in the contemporary world. His following runs in the millions, if not the tens of millions. And Kaolack is the city which he founded in 1929, Medina Kaolack, which is a city in the suburbs of Kaolack, and which has become a major center, spiritual center, center for pilgrimage and learning. And my mother, who also is a scholar of her own right, she passed away December 2020. But she is considered one of the most influential, also Islamic educator in Africa. Her name is Sheikha Mariam Ibrahim Niass. She has established many schools, trained thousands of people in a career which spans a period of 6 to 7 decades. So I was exposed to that story, to Kaolack, to the Tijaniya Tariqa, to Tijaniya Sufi order, and to Islamic erudition. And when I went to public schools and engage in conversation with other students who were only trained in the European languages, I realized the disconnect, between their knowledge of Islamic of African erudition and the reality that there is a lot that they didn't know, because they believe that the history of education or formal education in Africa starts with colonialism. And I think that was a very wrong assumption, because for centuries, Africans have been participant in the production of Islamic knowledge. They have written in Arabic. They have also written in Ajami. Ajami meaning using the Arabic script in order to transcribe African languages. And there is an attested usages of Ajami in 80 African languages, you know. So which means that the history of erudition, the history of sophisticated knowledge transmission by no means started with European colonialism, by no means started with the introduction of the colonial school system and its pedagogy.
You open this edited volume that we're discussing, Islamic Scholarship in Africa, with an anecdote in the words of your grandfather.
Right. He performed the pilgrimage to Mecca for the first time in 1937, and he was received together with other 16 scholars from different Muslim countries by King Saud of Saudi Arabia. And the story he tells is that when he spoke, he impressed the audience so much that one of the scholars wanted to know where he lived in Egypt and asked him, "Where do you live in Egypt?" He said, "I have never been to Egypt." And then the scholar was very surprised, you know, how this black person who has never been to Egypt could be so learned. And he asked him, "Where did you study?" He said, "I studied with my father." He said, "So when did your father graduate from Al-Azhar University?" He said, "My father never attended Al-Azhar or any other school anywhere in the world. He studied only with his father." So he was surprised, but that he or his father, for that matter, acquired sophisticated Islamic education in Africa, that stands to reason, as I said. Because before the erection of colonial boundaries, texts and scholars circulated all over the world so that any text could be taught anywhere in the world, at least in the Islamic world. Pilgrimage was an important part of the process of learning, because scholars, they travel not just to perform the pilgrimage, but also to study or to teach in centers of learnings along the way to the pilgrimage. So therefore, before the erection of colonial boundaries, you know, scholars traveled in many parts of the Muslim world. They exchanged knowledge, and books also circulated so that they could be taught anywhere. And if you look at the core curriculum of most of the schools, you will see that the texts that they were studying and teaching were the same. And because people could travel to the pilgrimage and stop in many centers of learning along the way, they will bring back to Africa texts written by scholars from all over the world. And so this is evidence that Africans have long been part of a global network of intellectual exchange, African Muslims.
You talk in Beyond Timbuktu about how you grew up so connected to and immersed in this broad intellectual network that transcended what you call your parochial identities in many ways, and that this is such a longstanding tradition that had been so marginalized and sidelined by the colonial library and its epistemologies. And I wonder, and I don't mean this at all in any reductive way, but how much of the effort, the intellectual effort behind Timbuktu and your work is about writing a history in which you recognize yourself and your family's story?
I think what I try to do also, you are quite right, is to tell the story of my family and, you know, for generations. But because my family is one of the scholarly lineages of very, you know, old scholarly lineages going back to several centuries, to at least three centuries, you know. And I tried by, you know, writing these books and referring often to my family to tell a story which by no means is only the story of my family, but the story of, you know, of Islamic erudition in Africa and how it was transformed. So in Beyond Timbuktu, I explain, you know, how the school created by my mother, which initially was only a Quranic school in the yard of our house, after six decades was transformed to become a network of schools mirroring very much how Islamic education was transformed after colonialism, with the encounter of colonialism. Initially, there were only Quranic schools and higher Islamic education, but later on, with the transformation that took place during the colonial period, new types of schools named as Franco-Arab, or, you know, or Islamia in the Francophone English-speaking countries of West Africa were created. And these combine traditional Quranic Islamic education with some study of Western languages and subjects, so-called secular subjects. You know, that was one aspect of the transformation. And there also existed, you know, schools that operated uniquely or only in Arabic. So I show that how the school systems created by my mother, how it was transformed from being initially only Quranic school to later being, you know, Franco-Arab and at the same time only Arabic, shows, you know, the transformation that occurred during the colonial period. You see?
And these traditions of knowledge, epistemologies that in the colonial mind frame have been separated on the ground in people's lived experiences, there's no definitive choice. You know, as you say, it's people imbricate what different ways of knowing and different intellectual traditions. And it's been a false project to separate them out. And this is so clear when you talk about in the beginning of the edited volume, how you were just trying to get some books for your class, Islam in Africa, at one of the best resource libraries in the world, and it posed such a challenge.
Yes, indeed. When I was appointed to the Divinity School, one of the first courses that I taught was readings in the Islamic archives of Africa, which consisted of, you know, reading texts written in Arabic by West African scholars. But the librarian of the Divinity School could not order those books because he said, you know, he does not know Arabic and has no expertise in Islamic studies. So he referred me to the librarian of the, you know, Middle Eastern libraries, you know, at the Widener Library in Harvard, but he could not order Arabic books from West Africa because it was not his field. You know, he specialized in the Middle East and in North Africa, but referred me to the librarian of African studies who could not order Arabic books for me because she specialized in sub-Saharan Africa. Things have changed now, you know, but the division of labor in the academy made it very difficult for people to study, you know, Islam in Africa or Islamic intellectual tradition in Africa. So finally I got the books because the dean used his discretionary funds in order to order those books for me. But the division of labor, you know, between Middle Eastern and sub-Saharan really made it impossible for me or before me for students who were there at Harvard studying Islam in Africa to get those books. And that balkanization of sub-Saharan Africa is what I try to challenge in my work and in, you know, to show that North and West Africa have been connected and have exchanged for centuries, and the Saharan Desert was by no means a desert separating these two regions. So the relations between North and Sub-Saharan Africa at times were very violent, but at times also they were very peaceful. You know, they involved the slave trade, the Oriental slave trade, war, conquest, but they also involved diplomacy and peaceful spiritual and intellectual exchanges. And I felt that that part of the story was not known to many people, partly because they didn't know Arabic, but also partly because of the division of labor separating North Africa from Sub-Saharan Africa. And usually, you know, African studies consisted mostly in the study of African religion, not Islam, whereas Islamic studies specialized more on the Middle East and North Africa, so that most experts of Islamic studies would have little interest in Islam in Africa or even engage the literature produced by scholars working on Islam in Africa. So yeah, I think that that division of labor in the academy was a real problem. But the good news is that things are changing now, and more scholars of Islam in Africa are being appointed in major universities, and they are also publishing books in major university press, and their work now is being visible in the larger field of Islamic studies. And that was one of the greatest challenge that we face, really, people working on Islam in Africa.
Yeah, the first part of this edited volume is really devoted to focusing on this history of these global trans-Saharan exchanges of knowledge, and really centering Black and sub-Saharan scholars as not junior partners, as you say, in these exchanges, but very much active and authoritative
right.
agents. Indeed. And I wondered if you could speak a little bit about, the backdrop to this is the French colonial idea of Islam noir, which is stereotyped as passive and not generative of knowledge and expertise, and how attention to the racialized aspect of Islamic knowledge is now really being foregrounded in this new scholarship.
Right. I think you are quite right that the idea of Islam noir or Islam du terroir, you know, the notion of Black Islam, which is different from Arab Islam, which is more syncretic, less erudite, less warlike, more peaceful, all these stereotypes, you know, are the legacy of the colonial library and of, you know, colonial writings about Islam in Africa. But it's not just the French who had those, prejudice and preconceived ideas. And the anecdote that I tell in the beginning of Sheikh Ibrahim's, being asked where he lived in Egypt, because people couldn't possibly, the scholar that he met in Mecca couldn't possibly imagine that in Africa, you know, one could receive this, higher education, Islamic education. And and this is very strange because, as you said, in the first part of the edited volume entitled History, Movement and Islamic Scholarship, there are tales of very prominent African scholars in the centers of learning in the Middle East, right? So therefore, far from being only junior partners, they contributed equally to the production of Islamic knowledge. Much as Africans were going to study in centers of learning in North Africa, they were also teaching there, just like today. You know, there are some people who study in France or the United States, and then are appointed in American or French or British schools to teach. So it was very much the same. Africans who traveled to the Middle East, some of them settled there. They studied, but also they were very prominent teachers among them. And it was not just a one-way street. Scholars also and students from North Africa, from Egypt, traveled to Timbuktu or other centers of learning in Africa in order to study or to teach also. So by no means African scholars were junior partners in this relationship with the other scholars. And I explain also that the history of the presence of African students in centers of learning in North Africa or Egypt is very old. And the first residents of students from West Africa, from Bornu in Egypt, in Al-Azhar, known as Riwaq al-Barnawi, was established in the 13th century, in the mid 13th century. And in the 18th century, among the 25 residents of students in Al-Azhar Mosque College in Egypt, three were residents of Africans, and they had more than the Maghrib at that time. Just to tell you that this is a very long story. Their presence in centers of learning all over the world is a very long story. And Africans have made solid contributions to all fields of knowledge. And some of the essays features in the volume, you know, constitute major contributions to astronomy, chapter 5, to political theory, astronomy, chapter 2, political theory, chapter 5, philosophy, chapter 6, jurisprudence, chapter 7. And these are just few, you know, just to tell you that, in fact, you know, the African contribution, and when I say African, I mean more particularly sub-Saharan African contribution to knowledge production, Islamic knowledge production, is quite substantial.
And I think in parallel to this, this volume is deeply historical and gives us a sense of how far back these histories go. But at the same time, what's so interesting about it is it's very cutting edge. There is a chapter on e-Sufism, and there's a lot of attention to the ways that social media and ICT and other technologies are really changing not just Islamic erudition, but also the ways that academics are studying Islamic erudition.
Indeed, I think you refer to the chapter on the new orality by Diego Gonzalez, you know, who explains how, you know, Sufi communities in West Africa have reappropriated the new technologies of information and communication in order to spread their message and teachings in the entire world. Some sheikh are being in Senegal, and they are, you know, giving spiritual initiation, transmitting, initiating knowledge to other people in the United States or in Malaysia. So it's just fascinating how these communities that some anthropologists predicted, you know, a while ago that they will, you know, decline with modernity because they are unfit to modernity, to urban life. They are, you know, just communities adapted to tribal or rural life, how wrong they are. So, and since you mentioned Sufi communities, you know, it's they're rich now. West African Sufi communities, their reach is global. And in April 2021, I hosted a conference on the Faida Tijani Sufi community in the 21st century. An Articulation of Global Islam. That was the title. It was hosted here at Harvard, and the proceedings of that conference will soon be out. And it deals really with the global spread of this Faida Tijaniya community, which used to be only West African, but with the immigration of Africans, of West Africans, Muslims in the West, and they are present all over the in all Western countries, with their immigration there and with the development of these new technologies of information and communication, these communities are flourishing, and their reach is really truly global now.
These binaries are so brittle, and this whole volume is just another of these so many examples of how much more complexity there is behind them. I think maybe the third kind of major dichotomy that the volume addresses is the supposed tension between orality and textuality. And this idea, particularly, that comes from the 1960s and 1970s, that African knowledge and local knowledges are oral. This is something that really marginalizes or obfuscates so much of the history that you're talking about a deeply textual intellectual culture. But even more than that, not just this dichotomy, but how textuality and orality work together. I wonder if you can talk a little bit about the complexity between this relationship and how some of the contributions unpack it.
Right. So, in fact, by documenting the literary cultures of Africa through the study of manuscripts and biographies of prominent Muslim scholars, prominent scholars or pioneers in the field of Islamic scholarship in Africa, they have refuted the notion that Africa had no written literacy tradition, no written literary tradition prior to European colonial rule. However, as you have rightly pointed out, they have failed to clarify the ways in which orality and textuality interact in the transmission of knowledge. First of all, by no means even scholars who wrote, they also transmitted knowledge orally. Some of the contributors, for example, show that Lidwin Kaptenge and Alessandra Vianello in chapter 14, they document very well the ways in which Somali Sufi Sheikh composed religious didactic poems orally and in writing. The same thing, is done by Oludamini Ogunayike, who also shows the importance of orality, who argued that substantial knowledge could be transmitted without leaving any written traces, especially when dealing with initiating knowledge, which means that scholars wrote, but they also transmitted important knowledge orally. So on one hand, textuality and orality have never been separated in this Islamic pedagogy. They are two faces of the same coin. Scholars wrote texts, but they transmitted knowledge orally on one hand. Therefore, the assumption that textuality is necessarily superior to orality is problematic. It is one of the things that, this volume, challenges, showing that, important, substantial knowledge can be transmitted without leaving any written traces for many different reasons, because they were initiating knowledge. Not everybody was supposed to know them. So therefore, there were no written traces, and only masters will teach them to only their trusted disciples. So I think these are very important issues addressed by the volume, the relationship between textuality and orality. To say that Africa had also a written literary tradition doesn't mean that orality is superior, is inferior, or that those who participated in this written tradition and who composed treatises did not teach orally, or that they did not compose orally, texts or, poems that were not even written.
You know, it strikes me as so ironic that we discuss this right now as we're recording a podcast, oral medium, on a text, right? You know, even this exact institution is the interplay of orality and textuality in order to reach different types of audiences in different ways and with different avenues in.
Indeed.
Which was why I think the podcast is a wonderful medium. I wanted to move towards the final essay in the book, which is really a powerful piece of writing by Ibrahim Sall. And if you're listening and you're interested in a very succinct and effective analysis of the ways of what he calls epistemic self-affirmation of Africa is unfolding, I really recommend this essay. And I wondered about this phrase, the epistemic self-affirmation of Africa. It strikes me that this is a great deal what could describe your work. And in addition to your work, how do you see this project moving forward in the field of Islamic scholarship and in the field of African studies?
Okay, so just allow me to remind you that Ibrahim Sall, who wrote the conclusion, was the former executive secretary of CODESRIA. CODESRIA is the Council for the Development of Social Research in Africa. And CODESRIA is one of the leading African think tanks. And CODESRIA was established by the Egyptian Samir Amin and some other prominent African intellectuals in order precisely to reclaim that epistemic sovereignty, in order to mobilize Africans across, colonial linguistic divide to think together on how to offer solutions to the problems that Africa were facing, problems of development, problems also of epistemicide, and so they promoted African research and African scholars and many very prominent intellectuals, African intellectuals who are now serving in Western universities are actually associated with CODESRIA. They were part of this effort of challenging the global epistemic order and struggling for an epistemic justice, which by which Africa's contribution to knowledge would be fully recognized. And I think that the study of Islamic erudition in Africa, and the importance that it had for African intellectual history, but also for Islamic intellectual history, is part of this epistemic struggle. And some may think of Arabic and Islam as, a form of imperialism, because Islam came from the Arabian Peninsula, and Arabic is, after all, a language which was born in Arabia. But that language has such a long history in Africa, and Africa reappropriated it for itself, or Africans have reappropriated the Arabic language for themselves, either in the using of the language itself or the using of the script in order to transcribe their language, that we cannot understand fully African intellectual history without looking at that contribution. And this research that I am doing, and people like me, on Islamic erudition in Africa, and especially this volume in which we worked for several years with a group of scholars trying to identify what needs to be, what new questions need to be addressed, you know, is part of that that effort for epistemic justice. And if you just if allow me to mention that one part of the volume also deals with Ajami, or the use of the African, the Arabic script to transcribe African languages. It was widely used. It remains still widely used to not just to not just for illiterate audiences in Arabic or people who didn't know Arabic, but there was a very sophisticated literature and poetry in Ajami. In other words, Ajami was not used only to explain basic Islamic knowledge to African people who didn't know Arabic. It was also, you know, it's an intellectual tradition of itself, as some several of the articles dealing with the very elaborate poetry composed by Senegalese, by Somalian, by Kenyan, etc. So to say that Ajami was very important, therefore, and again, Ajami means using the Arabic script in order to write in African language. So that's a very important tradition. And what we try to do in this volume is to stress the importance of studying Ajami, not just as, you know, something of the past, you know, or not just focusing on, you know, on old manuscripts, but also as a living language. Up until now, people are using it, they are writing in Ajami, even for literate audiences.
Absolutely. And I, as a very ignorant person, was surprised to discover that there were 80 languages that had used Ajami script. And I wondered, is there ongoing research to discover if there are more?
Well, 80 languages in Africa, you know, with an attested usage of the Arabic script. Yeah. So that's the findings of a book on the Arabic script in Africa published a few years ago. Yes, there are many scholars who are working on Ajami. Even, you know, I have a doctoral student who just joined, you know, our doctoral program in order to study Mandinka Ajami. Professor Falun Gom at Boston University, you know, also study Ajami. He studies Ajami. So yeah, there is a growing interest in Ajami, in understanding Ajami, in studying Ajami, especially Ajami, you know, in the contemporary period, because it remains very much of a living tradition.
So even though we've been through this global pandemic, and we are continuing to be part of this global pandemic, you continue to be as prolific as ever. What are your current and future projects in addition to what you've already mentioned?
As part of the mission of my position, you know, I organize every year an Islam in Africa conference. And the volume, Islamic Scholarship in Africa, New Directions in Global Context, you know, there is a findings of the first two conferences. The first one was organized in February 2017, and it was entitled "The Text, Knowledge, and Practice: The Meaning of Scholarship in Islamic Africa." And the second one was entitled was organized in November 2017. You know, a few months after the first, which was organized in February 2017, and it was entitled "Islamic New Directions in the Study of Islamic Scholarship in Africa." Then the third conference was entitled "West Africa and the Maghreb," and the fourth, "Africa, Globalization and the Muslim World," and findings of these two conferences also are in press as a special issue of religion entitled "Africa, Globalization and the Muslim World." So, and the fifth conference, which was organized in April 2021, dealt with the Faida Tijaniya conference, a major articulation of global Islam. And also I am now editing these papers that will be published soon. And the next conference will be on love poems for the Prophet and Muslim saints in Africa, composition, performance, and reception. And that's what I am working on. So not clear when, because ideally, such conferences should be in person. And the April one is the only one of the, five mentioned conference that was organized online. So we are hoping that it would be possible to organize it in person soon. But so these are the ideas to try to, chart new directions in the field, especially through conferences and also through lecture series, because I organize a lecture series also and invite scholars who have just published new books in the field here on campus to present their works, as well as advanced doctoral students also to present their work. So we try to create a community of scholars working in the field in order to, make a contribution and to chart new directions.
So much to look forward to, and so much work to come.
Indeed.
I wanted to close by reading you back to yourself. I thought this phrase was really apropos of our conversation here and what the New Books Network tries to do. In the epilogue of Beyond Timbuktu, you write, "Unlike the modern context in which students learn much from reading books alone in their rooms, in the classical period, the most reliable method of knowledge transmission was students hearing the author of the text or someone who had been taught the text teach the lesson." So I thank you for having taught us some lessons speaking about your texts. And I look forward to when you'll be back to discuss future work.
Thank you very much, Elisa. I feel really very honored to be invited to this podcast, and also look forward to continuing the conversation when the other volumes will be out. And I hope that there will be interest in a podcast also on those volumes.
We're always here. Thank you very much, Professor Khan.
You're very welcome.